The Money Show
with Motheo Kgwaripe
on 702. Let's walk the talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Good evening and welcome to the Friday edition of The Money Show. Hopefully you've had a good week on this short week. We're going to be looking at rethinking visas, visa policies in South Africa, encouraging skilled immigration for South Africa's growth. Of course, a lot of South Africans have gone out to seek new pastures elsewhere around the world, especially with our slow growing economy. But how can we attract new skills into our economy? Hilary Joffe, columnist and editor at large at The Business Day, will help us with that conversation. Then in our Money Show Explainer, looking at China, the world's second largest economy. They've had quite high growth rates over the years, but things seems to be going quite slowly this time around. Professor Adrian Saville, economics and finance professor at Gibbs, will join us for that conversation. Is China too big to fail, and what happens then to the world economy if this big consumer of goods cannot keep up with that growth rate? And then later on, we cover markets with Patrick Matidi, head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners. Saw the JSE surging yesterday, all green, in fact, on local market, but only to be quite short-lived today in negative territory. We'll find out what that's about. Then what makes a premium cigar or stogie? If you are a person who's into luxury cigars or stogies and you want to find out what makes the perfect one, Kojo Bafor, an author and aficionado of cigars, will be talking to us in our Friday file. Then later on, we'll have the best bits on The Money Show.
The Money Show with Motheo Kgwaripe
on 702.
Well, we always see the headlines every year of South Africans leaving for greener pastures elsewhere in the world. The numbers and data differ on this, but also there is concern around South Africa's visa policies for those seeking opportunities in our country. Joined by Hilary Joffe, now columnist and editor at large at The Business Day. Of the data that you've collected for the article that you wrote, Hilary, can you give us some of the issues that South Africans, those that are leaving, some of the reasons rather they're leaving, and some of the reasons why we can't get enough skilled people into the country?
There's a survey, Motheo, by Statistics South Africa, which is a new survey, which for the first time has given us some numbers, which shows about 26,000 people a year in the last 5 years or so have been leaving the country. We don't know whether they return. We don't actually know why they go. The data are actually quite minimal, but at least we have some numbers. I think anecdotally, if you talk to people, we're getting a lot of people who just getting opportunities from abroad. You know, the accounting firms are complaining that people get poached. And as one of them said, it's not a matter of color anymore. It's black chartered accountants just as fast as white chartered accountants. You know, some countries in Europe and the US, which have had really significant labor and skill shortage, have been aggressively recruiting. And I'm sure you've heard stories of people going to the Netherlands, to Germany, to the UK, to Ireland. They're getting job offers, and they're getting job offers in economies which have shortages themselves and have until recently been growing more strongly than our economy. So I think it's a bit of a pull factor. And we're also getting a lot of youngsters who go overseas to Australia or to travel if they can, and they get jobs there. So we are losing a whole cohort, I think, of skilled people. Often, and it's not the skills or the degree that you've got. It's the 5 or 10 years of experience that you've built up that's really valuable to employers. And I think we're losing people at that sort of stage. But that's really anecdotal. I don't think that we have hard data on that, and we would love to have hard data. But Motheo, you also asked about the immigration. You know, so immigration of the country and losing skills and letting people go and spread their wings would be less of a problem for South Africa if we were encouraging skills to come in. But we are making it pretty much impossible and have been for the last several years. And that means for employers who need to bring in executives from branches elsewhere or experts in particular fields, it's you know, again, there are all these anecdotes, and there's quite a lot of evidence in the report that the presidency prepared last year that it is an absolute battle in South Africa. They compared South Africa to a number of other countries, including countries like Kenya, not just Australia or wherever. And the waiting times and the bureaucracy are much worse here. And the evidence there is on Home Affairs' own data. Only 26,000 skilled work visas across the various categories of skilled work visas were granted in the six-year period to 2021. Now, that's less than 5,000 a year. So just imagine, we're losing more than 20,000 people a year. We are letting in this tiny fraction of 5,000 people a year who are would-be taxpayers, who are bringing know-how, who are bringing their experience from abroad. And that is actually quite a constraint on our productivity and our growth and even with our job creation, because a lot of the evidence is that each skilled worker has the potential to create more than one unskilled job.
One imagines that, you know, the length of time it takes to get a CEO, whether in the banking sector, mining sector, we've seen how long it takes in South Africa. If you were to have, you know, a foreign national who happens to have the skills and wants to join a South African company or a company here on our shores, you'd want to make that process as quick as possible. What is causing all these hurdles and the time it takes to sign on some of the skill?
Look, I could suggest a rather xenophobic bureaucracy in government and a whole bunch, and also a visa regime which is terribly complicated and had requirements which took sort of months and years to get clearance. So what the new regulations, which were finally published on Thursday, just before the Easter weekend, the new regulations which talk to the recommendations which were made by this review for the presidency and by Home Affairs itself last year, introduce at least two new categories of visas to replace the kind of very outdated critical skills list and, you know, all these other work visas. I don't know if they replace them, but they certainly new categories which will make it much more flexible and much easier. And instead of government saying, we need, you know, we want this and not that, you say the point system, which is being introduced, which is similar to what a lot of countries have. I mean, people, you know, will be familiar with it from Australia, from the UK. That's how they do it. They encourage highly qualified people with good, with or without good experience, with good, useful degrees of any whatever sort, who are relatively highly paid, and who employers want to hire,
yeah,
to come into the country. And if you meet those criteria, you're going to earn a certain salary, you've got certain qualifications, you've got X experience, you're in. So it's not a whole bureaucracy where the government decides whether they want, you know, plumbers or bricklayers. That's the one kind of category. The other category, which is kind of, you know, we need to get up with the world, is the remote work visa. So that, you know, people who want to work remotely here for foreign employers can do that and enrich, if you like, our own local economies.
And those, of course, are looking to sites like Cape Town, where it's become quite popular there.
Absolutely.
Hilary, yeah, Joffe, the columnist and editor-at-large at the Business State. The Department of Home Affairs saying that some spousal or relative visa applications take up to 2 years to process because of the documentation and claims that need to be verified. The backlog eradication plan, where 117 additional officials have been pulled in from the other provinces to work through these particular applications, hopefully gets quite faster, especially for that skilled labor that's trying to enter into our economy.
The Money Show will give you all the tools you need to navigate the complicated world of economics and commerce, even if you're not a numbers person. The Money Show
with Motheo Paripe,
6 to 8 p.m. Making money makes sense
on 702 and Cape Talk.
Let's get into the world's second largest economy, China, of course, after 1949, introduced quite effective economic reforms, and China then became the world's factory, if you will, ramping up manufacturing and also really having the rest of the world rely on that cheap labor and also the quick turnaround times in terms of lead time for products. And that's what's driven the Chinese economy so far. But starting to see some cracks, especially after the pandemic period, after those hard crackdowns in terms of businesses in China operating during the COVID period. Joined now by Professor Adrian Saville, Professor of Economics and Finance at Gibbs. Is China too big to fail, or are we starting to see a giant go on its knees, especially looking at the growth rates and also the unemployment rates in China?
Mateo, you know, the challenge for China is it's run into some real headwinds which are going to be difficult to reverse. And three of the most obvious headwinds are the very, very big property sector, which makes up about a quarter of GDP, and that is significantly bigger than in any other large industrial economy, where it's typically around 15% of GDP. So you've got this very bloated property sector, which has the makings of a financial bubble, or certainly in a financial risk for the banking sector. That's problem one. Problem two is they have an aging population, and China is the first country in modern times to become gray before it's got rich. It's still a middle-income economy, and the aging population means that the workforce is now shrinking. Perhaps a third a structural challenge that China faces is they have built the economy on the back of massive investment, which is often pointed to as a remarkable ingredient for success. But if anything, China has overcooked it, and they have overinvested, which has translated to the likes of ghost cities. And that overinvestment then starts to turn into a depreciating asset, which means you have to pedal even faster to try and keep the machine running at the same pace. So these are headwinds that are going to be very, very difficult to reverse, and they are not 1 and 2 year reversals if they happen. They're decade long reversals.
We've seen major tech companies move to the likes of India. There's also the chip wars that are currently going on, but also China dealing with a high unemployment rate for its youth. We've seen, the Chinese government try to make interest rates quite low so that investment still continues there. But is that enough of a silver bullet to fix that such a big economy?
No, I don't think so. And I don't want to come across as being, you know, too negative on the Chinese economy. It has some very strong positives behind it. But in this conversation, you're pointing to the obvious negatives. So, just staying with that, one of the challenges that the country has is having been investment-led and export-led. The export miracle is well documented. It means that they've got into the business of thinking that the way in which you drive the economy is through those channels. Yet, you know, when we look at economies, once they've started to approach maturity, they invariably flip from being investment-led and export-led to actually becoming consumer-led. And here in the rub, because the Chinese consumer accounts for only 37% of the economy, whereas if you look at the likes of Western Europe, the North Americas, Japan, Australia, etc., it's quite typical to have the consumer make up 60-65% of the economy. So what's missing in action in China is actually the consumer.
Then looking at this particular economy, surely the world wouldn't want China to fail. There's just too much at stake. How can China turn it around, and what positives can they focus on to make sure they keep up with those high growth rates?
Well, you know, in your observation, I think you're flagging an important thing. This isn't China's problem. It's actually the world's problem, because a stumbling or struggling China is going to be a very belligerent negotiator, a very, you know, belligerent member of any conversation about establishing or arranging world order, convening partnerships. If you know, if one member at the table is hungry or frustrated, far harder to, you know, to get to constructive arrangements. And you know, so if we think of the obvious discussions here, it's a U.S.-China discussion. I think it's in the U.S.'s interest to make sure that China gets into good shape. That means facilitating trade discussions, amongst other things. And unfortunately, I think both Biden and Trump, and it looks like we're getting Trump too, but you know, whether it's a Biden or Trump too, I think both of them are going to be opposed to a greater Chinese participation in trade channels. So this points to some real challenges for what I would call a new world order.
And of course, that could affect emerging markets like South Africa. Professor
Absolutely.
Adrian Saville, Professor of Economics and Finance at Gibbs.
The Money Show.
The Markets.
Well, if you were trading on Thursday, you would have been quite happy with the JSE. It was all green, rebounds from industrials, financials and resources shares. But a quick turnaround on Friday left the JSE in the red. We'll find out why now with Patrick Matidi, the head of equities at Aluwani Capital Partners. We saw industrials down 0.5% today. Financial shares also in negative territory, with resources shares and unable to drive up the JSE like it usually does. Telkom down 5% today. Amongst the losers, Resilient down 3.5%. Amplats, Sibanye Stillwater, the big miners, down 3%. With the car group Motors also not enjoying positive trades today. But it was a good day for WBHO, up more than 2%. Barloworld was up more than 1%, with the likes of Capitec, Sappi, and the Foschini Group enjoying gains of more than 1%. Patrick, looking at the markets today, what would have caused that quick turnaround? We were hoping to see a lot of green on the JSE for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, good evening, Mateo, and your listeners, and thanks for having me. Indeed, you know, we were hoping to build on yesterday's gains, but it was not to be. We were led lower by overnight markets, especially out of the US, where some commentary from some of the Fed officials, you know, gave the market a cause for concern with regards to the prospects for rates to come lower. And we saw that market close about 1.5% across the major indices. So that kind of set the tone for our markets. And also in Asia, when they closed before we opened, you know, there was that negativity that was lingering. So we opened on the back foot and pretty much stayed there for the better part of the day. And then towards the end, a little bit of a rally, but it was not enough, you know, to can lift us onto the positive territory, closing down about 0.8%, being better than some of the earlier levels where we were down about 1.2%.
Then a big jobs number coming out of the U.S., of course, non-farm payrolls climbing by more than 300,000 last month, the strongest in nearly a year. Another factor that could make a case for the cutting of rates to be pushed back a little bit.
Yeah, so that number is further confirmation that indeed, you know, the U.S. jobs market continues to be very, very strong. You know, that has been an area of focus, you know, from the authorities, just to see if there are no inflationary pressures building on from the labor market. And that number confirming indeed that, you know, it is strong, but also the unemployment number coming down, you know, to about 3.7% versus 3.8%. So the U.S. market, by all accounts, continues to be very strong. And that is obviously a cause for concern in terms of if it will cool down to the point of, you know, the authorities finding comfort to start cutting rates, hopefully second half of this year.
In commodities, though, the gold price seeming quite comfortable above that $2,000 mark. What's really driving that? Is it the safe haven as the tensions continue in the Middle East?
Yeah, so it's two factors. One, you mentioned the safe haven status, and given the geopolitical tensions that continue to simmer. And then the second one is that of a store of value. you know, given what could be a higher for longer inflation sort of environment globally. So we are seeing a lot of demand for gold, largely driven by those two reasons, both the physical market, the physical gold, but also, you know, financial assets that are backed by gold, let's say things like ETFs and the likes that investors are piling into.
It doesn't seem like we'll be getting any reprieve. I mean, petrol price is going up this week, but the Brent crude price now at $91.65 a barrel. And it seems, you know, the tensions between Iran and Israel could further drive up that price.
Yeah, so again, I mean, on the oil side, geopolitical tensions are driving that oil price. But also we have seen on the supply side, you know, OPEC sort of tightening the screws and not wanting to release more supplies into the market to try and calm, you know, that oil price and also have a lesser impact on inflation. So unfortunately for us, you know, we do import oil, and also it goes into our inflation basket in the form of petrol price. So a combination of a weaker rand and a high oil price, unfortunately, bodes bad for the petrol price and the inflation outlook and ultimately the interest rate outlook from the MPC.
Transaction Capital looking to list that we buy cars. Are we likely to get some fair value when it comes to that share price?
Look, hopefully, because that is a fairly good business. We buy cars. They specialize in pre-owned vehicles. We have seen, if you look at the numbers in terms of new vehicle sales, especially on the passenger side, that those continue to be under pressure. A combination of high financing costs, but also the car prices themselves are ticking up, you know, just given where inflation is and also where the currency is for a lot of those units that are imported. So consumers finding some relief, you know, in the second-hand car market, where the likes of, you know, We Buy Cars, I think they push about, you know, 15,000 cars per month, which is fairly decent. So the demand for second-hand pre-owned cars that are still, you know, reasonably new and in good condition, that remains strong with a good margin. So hopefully the market will buy that story and we'll see where it lists, you know, when it comes to the market on the 11th of April.
And just quickly, looking at South Africa's biggest insurer, Sanlam, showing that they still have the big guns, 2 billion rand, into the Indian market.
Yeah, so Sanlam has been in India for a while. You know, they started off, you know, with a smaller stake and they have been slowly but surely increasing that footprint over the last while. So now coming through and actually saying, look, you know, they're taking the plunge, they're taking a majority stake into Shriram, the life company that is based in India, moving from about 40% to just over 50% in terms of ownership. So that is good. So it's a great sort of, I guess, diversification, you know, given that some of these guys are complaining that the growth prospects for South Africa, yeah, the domestic market, is very slow. So China, India, economically, GDP-wise, has been growing very, very strongly amongst its EMPs. So, you know, well done for Sanlam. And hopefully, you know, that grows and continues to add value to the shareholders of Sanlam.
Thank you, Patrick Matidi, Head of Equities at Aluwani Capital Partners, covering the markets with us there. A very weak day for the JSE, but the rand at 18.65, quite strong against the dollar this evening.
You're with Motheo Faribe on 702 and Cape Talk.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by Absa. Some stories are just getting started. Your story matters. Absa is a registered FSP. Now let's get into our Friday file. They called stogies, puro, stick or cigars are an acquired taste that's been enjoyed by business moguls, politicians, revolutionaries and the everyday man with a taste for the finer things in life. But what makes a luxury cigar and what's out there once you graduate from the commercially successful Cuban Cohibas? In our Friday file, we review the Agarnorsa Leaf cigar with a man who knows far more than me about cigars, Koja Bafor, the author and cigar enthusiast, joining us for this particular conversation. Koja, looking at revolutionaries like Fidel Castro, you know, they made the Cohiba famous. What's the story behind this particular cigar?
How are you, Mateo?
Great, Kojo.
Cool. Sorry, you couldn't hear me earlier and I was busy screaming and shouting. I think the starting point is to step away from the idea of better than or worse than. And focus more on what one's preference is in terms of taste and flavor.
Yeah.
So the So the for me, the special thing about the Arginosan, one, it's not often I get to interact with like a new brand that I've never smoked before. So it's always an exciting time when I get access to a new brand with the different, you know, with the different cigars that they have under the brand. But what's interesting about Arginosa specifically is, I mean, it was started to grow tobacco for cigars and was started to grow tobacco for cigars in Nicaragua. But it retains a very kind of a Cuban style of growing and rolling cigars, as well as uses what's called Cuban seed. So you find that a lot of the seeds were taken from Cuba and have been planted in other places. So the origin of the tobacco is Cuba. So for me personally, what I find with Arginosa in particular is it marries the what I feel is the best of what you get from Cuba, from a Cuban cigar, a really good quality Cuban cigar, which is a similar element of consistency in flavors and tastes and the smoke, with the character and spiciness and flavor that you get from tobacco that's grown in Nicaragua.
Then what's so special about the Cuban seed, the Corojo 99? What about it makes it, you know, that one that you want to get for a cigar brand?
Well, I think because the association still is kind of when you think cigars, you think Cuba, right? And I think the whole industry and the growing of cigar tobacco, its roots are really in Cuba. So when you know, after the Cuban Revolution and you had different people kind of leaving Cuba, families that had been involved in cigar making, and going to other parts of particular Latin America, because there's this band where cigar tobacco grows really well. From a technical perspective, to be honest, like I'm still learning. So I couldn't tell you specifically in terms of, for example, the Corojo 99 leaf, what it is that makes it.
What do you enjoy most then about the cigar smoking? Because it seems like such, there's an art to it. The way you clip off the ends of a cigar, the special lighter that you need. Is it a little bit like wine tasting where there's different taste and spiciness and blends that you can talk about?
Exactly. I was actually just about to say that. So, I mean, there is an alchemy to, I mean, first of all, the making of the cigar. So it's not just a tobacco seed thrown on the ground and then it's harvested and then rolled into a cigar. I mean, Plasencia, one of the brands, they have a 573 step process from planting from seed to actual cigar in a box in retail. So it is like wine. It is like whiskey. There's a process to it. There's an alchemy to it. They do blends. The climate and the soil that the tobacco leaf is grown in, whether it's in shade or whether it's in sun, all of those things have an impact on the flavor. That's what kind of drew me to it, in terms of just learning that actually there's different blends, there's different types of cigars. I'm often asked, what's your favorite cigar? And I'm like, I don't like to eat the same meal every day. And I don't like to drink the same thing every day. And with cigars, it's exactly the same. There's different flavors in it. There's different blends. There's a whole process to, I'm always fascinated by stories. So the stories of kind of generations of families that have grown cigars, the story of a brand in terms of, how it carries the great grandfather started growing tobacco leaves and now the great great grandson is running a cigar brand. So those are the things that fascinate me. But at the end of the day, I mean, I always say for me, a cigar is about time. Because when you light a cigar has a certain burning time. So it could be a 45-minute smoke, an hour smoke. That means that I'm going to be in one place in the company of whoever or whatever it is I'm in the company of. And I'm going to take time for myself. So it's
more for slow living than leisure, if you will.
Yeah, to a certain extent. And you know, there's still the stereotype in terms of, you know, cigars are for the wealthy, cigars are for, you know, dare I say, people sitting in suits around in a gentleman's club.
Well, they don't come cheap. They don't come cheap. I guess that's why.
They don't come cheap. But I mean, people spend money on lots of different things that don't come cheap. So it's really kind of what is the hobby that you want to pursue? You know, some people drink, you know, expensive whiskeys or expensive wines, or just whiskeys and wines, and you're buying a lot of those. You know, some people enjoy fashion, some people enjoy vehicles. So it really is about, you know, what is it that makes you content and fulfills you?
And what goes well?
And my particular.
Sorry, Kojo. I just wanted to go into the pairing of cigars. Is it a must to have it with a whiskey or a wine, or you can just have it on its own? You don't have to pair it with drink.
I mean, on a good day, I have some of my favorite days. I've had a cigar at 9 o'clock in the morning. I'm not having alcohol with it.
Is this on an island or just like in your own space here at home?
On the patio at home. You know, for me, I enjoy cigars and I enjoy cognac. That doesn't mean that they have to go together. You know, I enjoy a cigar for a cigar, and I enjoy a cognac for a cognac, and sometimes I do them together. Actually, not often do I do them together. So, you know, I'll have a green tea, you know, if I feel like a green tea. I mean, this evening I'll probably have an Agonosa with a cup of tea or some juice, because I'm there to enjoy the cigar and what the cigar gives me. And pairing you can do, and I've done pairings before. You have to get really creative with pairings, because then you are looking at two different kind of flavor notes, because it's also not, you know, a cognac or a whiskey, it's not one flavor.
Yeah.
There's a couple of flavors. So you're having to look at how to pair that with the cigar that you're smoking. So if you're smoking a stronger cigar, like a full-bodied cigar that has a lot of earthiness in it, or a lot of spiciness, then you also have to kind of think about the liquid that you're pairing with it, to ensure that they complement each other as opposed to overpowering each other.
And this special Agonosa leaf cigar, can one source it here in South Africa? Or is it something you have to get online from elsewhere in the world?
No, you can source it in South Africa. So, I mean, that's how I discovered. Well, I found out about it and I've started smoking it. So,
look, we don't want to get into your finances, but how much do these go for? Yeah.
The Agonosas, so far what I've seen, they probably range from about like 350 rands a stick, up to probably 450.
All right, if you want to get into cigars or stogies, just try out something new. The Agonosa Leaf Cigar. Kojo Bafor, author and cigar enthusiast, they're taking us through the life of luxury cigars.
Motel Faripe on The Money Show.
6 to 8 p.m.
It might have been a short week, but we still had some interesting content for you here on The Money Show. Time now for the brutal biz quiz. Time for those bragging rights. So, fastest fingers first to those phones. My first question tonight: who or which country is the largest producer of cigars? Who or which country is the largest producer of cigars? If you do know the answer to that question, you can call us on 011-883-0702, or if you're in Cape Town, call us on 021-446-0567. Who or which country is the largest producer of cigars? If you know the answer, or you just want to give it a try, do call us and get the bragging rights for the brutal biz quiz.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield is brought to you by APSA. Your story should be heard. Your story matters. APSA is a registered FSP.
If you just joined us, we are busy with the Brutal Biz Quiz. The first question, who or which country is the largest producer of cigars? In our Friday file, we just spoke about cigars. If you do know the answer to that question, you can call us on 011-883-0702. Or if in Cape Town, you can call us on 021-446-0567. Selby in Benoni, do you know the answer to that question? Which country is the largest producer of cigars?
I think it's Cuba.
Cuba would have been my guess as well, but it's not quite the right answer. Thank you for trying, Salvi, there in Benoni. We're looking for that particular answer. Who or which country is the largest producer of cigars? If you're willing to give it a go, do call us on 011-883-0702. In Cape Town, call 021-446-0567. We've got Rod in the East Rand, another East Rand caller trying. You guys do like stogies, don't you? Which country is the largest producer of cigars, Rod?
Okay, I think it's Cuba.
Another Cuban answer would have been my guess as well, but it's not quite the correct answer. It's another country in South America that does supply a good large lion's share of the U.S. Supply of cigars. If you want to look it up, do look it up and call us. I've got Tulani here in Randburg. Maybe third time lucky. Tulani, which country is the largest producer of cigars?
The Dominican Republic.
The Dominican Republic is the correct answer according to the Cigar Aficionado. 44% of the world's most traded cigars come from the Dominican Republic. Let's see if you can get the second one there, Tulani. In pet retail stores sectors, Checkers controls the pet shop science. What does Woolworths now control after this week? Woolworths bought a pet store this week. Think about it. I think we discussed it on the show earlier in the week. They have a more than 90% shareholding of this particular pet store. Woolies going into pet care and also getting into that particular market. So if you know the answer, what does Woolworths control in terms of the pet industry? I'll need an answer from you, Tulani. What's that?
I mean, I don't have that one. I didn't listen to the show.
Unfortunately not. Of course, we have Vusi in Midrand. Let's see if you can give us the answer and give Tulani some new knowledge around this South African retailer, Woolworths, getting into the pet world. What particular company do they now have a majority shareholding in? Vusi.
Montague or something like that.
Montague's a good guess, but not quite the answer we're looking for tonight. Roger, do you know the answer to that question? Woolies going into the pet sector. Which particular company do they get a majority stake in?
Woolies.
They bought into a Montague. Pet company. Oh, man.
Montague.
Another Montague's answer. Not quite the answer we're looking for, Roger. Thanks for trying today. John in Four Ways, do you know the answer? Checkers controls pet shop science. Woolies bought into which company?
How are you, boss?
I'm good. How are you, John?
It's Absolute Pets.
Absolute Pets is, of course, the absolutely correct answer. And I guess you get the bragging rights today. Regulators gave Woolworths the green light to acquire Absolute Pets. In October of 2023, Woolworths announced its intention to acquire 93.4% of the shares in privately owned pet retailer Absolute Pets from Sanlam Private Equity and Absolute Pets Management. The Woolies are getting into the pet industry, something they hope will be lucrative. We got that final answer. And that wraps up, of course, the Brutal Biz Quiz and leaves us at 7 o'clock. Time for Eyewitness News. After that, you can enjoy the best bits of The Money Show.
The Money Show with Bruce Whitfield was brought to you by APSA Corporate and Investment Banking, bringing you award-winning trade and working capital funding solutions to unlock the full potential of your business story. APSA is a registered FSP.